Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in air by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. Views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour program is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Oh, yeah, and we're proud to have all of those people support and our organization support, and we support them, too.
Indeed.
And you can show your support for WEFT yourself by calling 359-9338. That's 217-359-9338. And making a generous pledge.
Yes, and we got a pledge right before we came into the studio here from Ricky Baldwin for $100. Thank you, Ricky. Ricky Baldwin's a staff person for the SEIU.
You know he's not making tons of money.
No, but I mean, I think it's he just thinks that the show is very important, that the station is also important. It's right. Got all the good public affairs program and the very unique musical genre programs that you won't hear. None of this, none of the public affairs, none of the unique musical genre programs on any corporate radio station. And you know, we are the only community radio station in the state of Illinois. There is another labor radio program that's in Chicago called Labor Express, but it's broadcast from a station that's owned by a Loyola University. So there are two labor radio shows in Illinois, but we are the only community radio station in Illinois. And we got to stay on the air, folks, because I'll tell you what, it costs money to, you know, pay the bills as far as electricity and all that.
Only two community radio stations in Illinois, and the other one's down by Carbondale.
Oh, I'm sorry, Bill. That's right. I'm sorry. So we are one of two.
And I don't know if they have a labor show or not. I don't know. I might just be doing some Googling here and seeing.
Oh, there is a labor show down there. In fact, it's done by Rich Whitney, who's the heads of the Illinois Green Party. His wife has a program there called Class Matters.
All right. Well, maybe we should be talking to her sometime.
You know what? I've been trying to get her on the air, and going to keep working on that. So, but anyway, Gus, I wanted to ask you a question about the GEO. You're currently the president of the Solidarity Committee?
Yes, the Solidarity Committee, which is the community organizing body of the GEO.
Okay. So, do you want to talk a little about what you guys are wanting to do here in the coming semester?
There's a lot going on right now in Champaign-Urbana, particularly around what the issue with Rauner and the healthcare issues, the state workers. So pretty much what our big concern is making sure that we are in solidarity with multiple groups and doing multiple actions. So, if there's an issue with, Champaign County healthcare consumers and mm-hmm. the Muhammad Aquifer, that they're leading the cause to, help secure that. We're helping in solidarity with them. The issue going on with the police brutality, the tasers that are coming up now, the North End Breakfast Club is leading the charge on that. CUCPJ is leading with that. So the GEO Solidarity Committee is in solidarity with them as well.
Okay.
And also, what are the other things going on with the gender justice group that the YWCA and a few other groups are leading? Then we're in solidarity with that. So the big thing with us this year is to make sure that we are not only visible in the community, but we establish a sustainable relationship in the community. And the only way we're doing that, as chair, I've opened the meetings to all community groups and campus organizations to come, and to student organizations, not the university administration, but for student organizations to come to the meetings,
mm-hmm.
and we actually are coming up with an organization calendar so that we can all attend each other's things and be supportive of each other.
Okay.
And so that, like I said, that's the big thing, because we want to make sure that when I leave and when other people leave, that there's a sustainable relationship and something that continues for the solidarity committee in the community, because that's the biggest problem with the GEO that's always been historically there is the lack of community engagement.
Yes.
You know,
and that's something endemic of just the, I guess, the logistics of the university. I mean, it's, it's like a separate community. And, even it's not like, I don't think most people on campus, are intentionally doing this, but it's just like it's difficult to go down to campus and park. Exactly. You know, that's one thing. That's one barrier. The other thing is, it seems like over the years, the university has become, the university police have been a lot more, restrictive, repressive about people from the community coming in, using university resources, you know, like playing basketball or going to the Illini Union and stuff like that. When I was growing up in the 70s, I mean, there was none of that crap going on. I mean, anybody from the community could go and do these things, you know?
Yeah, I felt like, I spent a lot of time, you know, in the union, on the quad and in different places, you know, for many years, and I always felt like it was my place.
Yeah, that's the thing too. That's what, and Martell Miller gave a great report about the issues with the campus police giving citations to people who go to the basketball courts and just play. Like, you know, that, like, they're not supposed to be there, in quotation marks. You know, and this is a public court that people can play on, and they're getting tickets and being threatened if they don't leave and don't come back. You know, that's an issue. And there's a coordinated effort by the university to keep the community away from the campus and vice versa. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've even heard students tell me that they've had people in the departments tell them not to go to certain parts of the community.
Really?
Yeah, if you go to, I forgot where it ends, the campus part for the students ends, but it tells them, like, you go past one particular street, don't do it. Like, stay away from that area. And that's pretty much the area where the groups of people, predominantly working class and poor blacks and whites mm-hmm. and Latinos live in this community. They tell them not to go there.
Yeah, university is the kind of the boundary on the north.
That's it. University.
And the Illinois Central Tracks is kind of the boundary that'd be on the west.
Yeah, when they give tours, when the students are coming into the campus at the end of the summer, the tour guides will tell them. And like, you know, this is something like, this is kind of a, This is kind of a secret thing that they've been doing for years, and that, again, that they're building that fraction between the community mm-hmm. and the campus, and that's something that we, as a solidarity committee, we cannot let happen. So, you know, that's my big push as chair.
Okay.
Don't go north of University Avenue unless it's to a huge apartment complex where they displaced a whole bunch of poor people living in trailers.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it was a crappy trailer park, but I mean, people got to live. Yeah. It had characters.
Yes. But and those places, like one you're talking about, the one a little bit north of there, I can't remember the name, but it used to be called Melrose Place. Remember, Bill, when you and Peter were hosting the show, there was a big scandal on that place when it was built. I mean, God, we could almost do a segment of a program on what happened back then. We need to do that sometime, because that's some interesting local history.
Yeah, speaking of illegal workers, undocumented workers, which was part of that mm-hmm. thing. By the way, there was the laborers have locals that are known as building wrecking locals.
Really?
Apparently in the big city still, like they have hod carrying locals.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember exactly where this was, but several years ago they were Donald Trump had a project that was sued by the local building wreckers because they had like 200 Polish, undocumented Polish workers, demolishing the building. So okay. Trump could build some.
Well, Gus, you know what? This is really important work that the GEO is doing as far as having an actual solidarity committee. This is something more unions need to be doing.
Exactly.
I mean, this is part of how, if you look back into history, this is how unions were able to get started and build strength, was this interaction with the community.
And I want to make it very clear to everybody that's listening that, you know, the biggest thing that Dave just said is so essential is the history of how unions are able to make progressive change is going into the community and having an open and sustainable relationship with the community. And that's something that the unions that did not do that, they didn't last very long, or they ended up making regressive changes because of problems with, you know, takeover and top down policies. That's one thing that we can't afford, especially in this climate with Rauner going after unions and organized labor in general, or workers in general.
Yes.
We have to maintain a relationship, and everybody has to know that we're fighting for labor rights, we're fighting for social justice as well, and we will not bend on that.
They go hand in hand.
Yes.
Yeah, and I'm really glad to see that because, people have, or at least they used to, I think since unions are so weak now, they don't really feel that way, but they used to feel like the union members thought they were better than everybody else and that unions were this and that, undesirable, too good of an advantage for their people and so on and so forth. We don't have that anymore. And one of the reasons we don't have that was because there was not any outreach like we're talking about right here. Hmm. Now I do conceive where there's problems. I cannot see at least some of the building trades unions, they are guilty of exactly what Gus was just describing. That is definitely the laborers and the carpenters in a nutshell right
there. I can vouch for the carpenters,
down.
Yes.
Number two, the membership is still insular and probably bigoted enough where they would totally oppose a lot of the initiatives that the SEIU would do, largely because the SEIU does have a very diverse membership.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that when we do our updates and talking about people like Dennis Williams for the United Auto Workers, who has that same type of policy that's really crippling the auto workers right now in their contract negotiations. It's that inability and really, not really inability, but willingness to avoid going in the community and opening a relationship. There's nothing wrong with telling people that you're fighting for labor rights, which are social justice issues, because that's what it is. People are afraid that this is some kind of radical idea, or that this is communism or some other ridiculous way that people stereotype fighting for social justice, fighting against racism, gender, sexuality, oppression, things like that. It's the most ridiculous idea ever, because they're all, like you said, Dave, they're intertwined. We have to remember that labor rights are social justice issues.
Okay, before the show I was doing some ranting, and I tell you what, nothing could be better for me on the job that I'm on right now if we could get at least one woman and one African American on the job. The conversation on this job would totally change. And I'm sorry, I am guilty of letting some things slide, but I cannot, just the way these things, I mean, things are getting bad enough for me in another realm anyway.
You can only do what you can, Bill, when you're only one and you're outnumbered, you know. you got to be able to defend yourself. If you could get at least one or a couple more allies, that'd change the whole dynamic.
Yeah, but I mean, the conversation would change.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Completely.
Yeah, and the conditions probably too. You know, real quick here, before Gus goes to his, report he's got on the United Auto Workers, I just want to let the listeners know that at half past the hour, John Ryman, a rank and file labor activist from Oakland, California, who's been he's been physically here on the show. In fact, it was back in October 2008 when the financial crisis was going on. And since then, he's called in many times to talk about several issues a day. He's going to be calling in today to talk about Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. And this might be a little controversial.
Yeah.
So a little controversy is going to be here. Anyway, stay tuned. It's going to be interesting, at least, even if you don't agree with everything that's said. So anyway, Gus, this is you want to talk about this United Auto Workers that's going on right now?
Yeah, I have two. I have two stories today that involves the auto industry in this country. The first one is what's going on with Fiat Chrysler auto workers. The second one I'm going to save until Dave lets me do this one because there's a human rights violation that happened in the GM decision that everybody heard about. I'll save that one for later. But for right now, something interesting just happened a couple days ago. Following a press conference earlier this week between United Auto Workers President Dennis Williams, our favorite concessionist who doesn't care about his workers, and Fiat Chrysler CEO Sergio Marchionne, if I pronounce that right, the UAW is moving as quickly as possible to push through the agreement. The union executives are meeting today and over the weekend to approve of the deal. Now, here's where things get nasty. So there is a deal in place that contract negotiations have been going on. But listen to this. Throughout the negotiations, auto workers have been told nothing about what the union and the company are planning. Before I even go any further, that's a key issue that should have had Dennis Williams tossed from his position. How do you have contract negotiations that you don't talk to the workers or the members? It's a complete lack of respect for the people. It's utterly unacceptable. Dennis Williams should be tossed immediately.
Yes.
And I'm calling for that right now.
I'm a laborer. We do not have negotiating committees, bargaining committees, no rank and file people involved at all. We don't even vote on our contract. For a while, a few years, we were getting to vote on what was done with the raises, whether it would go in the pension or on the check or whatever. But those choices were still defined by the leadership on their own. My union, my local, in 1998, was put in trusteeship over undemocratic practices. And look.
Mm-hmm. Now it's gotten even worse. Yeah, its only difference was you had a local gangster controlling your union as opposed to a corporate international union.
And now it gets worse too. Listen, the details actually of the agreement actually started leaking out into the press. And with both the UAW and FCA attempting to paint a major attack on workers, including a permanent reduction in base pay and a historic assault on healthcare benefits as a significant victory as workers. They're actually painting this as being like, this is a historic contract being negotiated. That's what Dennis Williams and Fiat behind closed doors eating expensive meals and expensive clothing. They're painting this picture to the media. So, the practice of the UAW has been to present workers with fraudulent highlights that cover up the extent of concessions, giving workers only a day or two, sometimes less, to consider these highlights before a vote. So workers have denounced these schemes. The UAW, and I quote, "The UAW needs to give us all copies of the entire agreement." This is from a worker, y'all. Mm-hmm. "The UAW, meaning Dennis Williams, needs to give us all copies of the entire agreement weeks before the vote and not just a few pages of the highlights telling us what we will receive and nothing about what they will be taking away from us."
Wow.
So again, this is going to go into our Bernie Sanders conversation in terms of these politicians and these people running for office. Don't give us something of what you expect for us to receive. We tell you what we want and what we need, and we put you in the office to do that. And that's what they did for Dennis Williams, and he is totally messing up. He is destroying the worker productivity of the people and their humanity in these types of concessions. He needs to go.
Yeah, this has been going on for 30 years. Each national president of the UAW has gotten worse and worse and worse over time. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is really tragic because the UAW used to be a very, very strong, militant democratic union back, you know, in the 30s, even up until the 1980s is when this started going downhill. That's a really good report. And you watch what happens next. The UAW is going to lose any right. The members are going to lose any right to vote in their contract, just like with the laborers and just like with the carpenters. Oh, yeah, the carpenters will say, oh, yeah, the carpenters union officials, they'll say, the members have a right to vote in the contract. You know, I've heard this from some younger rank and file members I've run into. I said, well, look at your bylaws from the district council, because every local in the carpenters district council could vote down that contract, but if the delegates at the district council approve it, it gets approved.
Wow.
So it's a phony vote. It's just it's all cosmetic.
Yeah. And there's something else too. I guess this must be have something to do with some labor law, but the laborers have industrial bargaining units besides, you know,
like carpenters used to too, but they got rid of all those.
Okay. Well, the industrial bargaining units, they vote on their contracts and they have contract negotiating committees with rank and file members.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, but for some reason, the building side doesn't get that.
Yeah. There you go. Okay. Bob, did you have a story?
Yeah, I wanted to give a quick update about the Seattle, teachers situation.
Oh, yes,
out
yes,
there.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. The walkout that began September 9th was put on hold this week after the teachers union and Washington State's largest school district reached a tentative contract agreement, and the full union membership's gonna vote on the deal this Sunday. So classes resumed on Thursday for the city's 53,000 public school students. The tentative deal gives teachers a 9.5% pay raise over 3 years, guaranteed 30-minute recesses for elementary school students, and more teacher input over standardized tests. Councilwoman Kashama Savant said that if the union wins, it'll be a huge step forward for students and educators, but it would also resonate outside Seattle. It says, besides the pay increase, bargaining position that the teachers ultimately greatly compromised on, that was just one item in a much more extensive list of demands. So also in the settlement terms were student-centered demands, including requests for guaranteed 30 minutes of recess for all elementary school students, additional staff such as school counselors and therapists, a reduction in over-testing of students, and the creation of new teams in 30 schools to ensure equitable learning opportunities and treatment of students regardless of race. Says that while recess may seem to be an unworthy demand, teachers understand it to be something critical to the health, development, and academic success of their students, as numerous research reports have found, and having access to school counselors, therapists, and other specialists is critical to many students, but in inadequately funded school districts such as Seattle, these are positions that are routinely the first to be cut.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh, by the way, that could not happen in Illinois. It's illegal for teachers in Illinois to strike over anything except wages.
Really?
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Wow.
And here's something else from Seattle. And this is yesterday, I guess, after 6 weeks of being blocked by anti-rent control committee members, Seattle City Council members Shama Sawant and Nick Licata introduced a resolution. He's a an African-American progressive Democrat on the city council, introduced a resolution to the city council's housing committee to lift the ban on rent control. Despite the council chamber being jam-packed with renters giving powerful testimony on why they need rent control, half the committee stood with developers. One even called the hearing on the resolution a, quote, distraction, unquote, and voted against recommending the resolution to full council. Moreover, appointed council member John Okamoto went as far to claim this resolution was politically motivated. This vote, combined with the near-constant drumbeat of attacks on rent control in the Seattle Times, points to one thing. The corporate and political establishment is on the attack and is determined to defeat rent control. And you got to understand that Seattle is like Boston, New York, San Francisco. I mean, a very expensive city where it's very difficult for working-class people to live anymore. However, you know, they're going to build on this momentum to win affordable housing and send a thunderous message to the establishment. It's really interesting. They go on to say, we know developers and landlords have the money and the majority of the politicians, but what they don't have is Shama Sawant. She's not for sale, and they don't have you. And they said, to date, over 170 CEOs and top executives and developers have given $80,000 to Shama's opponent that's running against her, an African-American woman from the Urban League, who instead of running against the other corporate Democrats on the city council, decided some reason to run for, against Shama Sawant. Anyway, this is for a city council seat, mind you. $80,000. Seven executives of Paul Allen's Vulcan Real Estate Company, which enabled Arizona's takeover of South Lake Union, Dana Bear, president of Howell Real Estate Investments, John Goodman, who's $2.5 billion Goodman Real Estate is notorious for predatory practices and widespread tenant evictions, and many, many more who profit off of escalating rents. So we'll keep you posted on that, but I think this is quite interesting. You know, everybody on the Seattle City Council is a Democratic Party council person, you know, but it's interesting, other than this one guy, let's see, what was his name again? Yes, Nick Licata. Other than him, all of them, and Shama Sawant, all of them are corporate Democrats. I mean, they're really, you know, they're all bought off of corporate money.
Yeah, have you ever noticed how in a lot of city politics, it's the developers?
Yes.
Yeah. And what is Donald Trump?
A developer.
Is he? Well, we can think of a lot of things that Donald Trump might be, but Gus, did you have it? Now, I want to let everyone know that Gus has a more extensive report on the UAW, which we're going to talk about, or he's going to talk about at the towards the end of the program today, after the caller calls in.
Yeah.
Do you have something else too? Before?
Yeah, this GM, the auto industry. Would you want me to save that for the end?
Yeah, because that's quite extensive. Yeah, I think it deserves the attention, the time.
How about this real quick story about Missouri right to work?
Oh yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, the right to work legislation died in Missouri veto session. That just happened this week. The bill received more favorable votes in the state house in the vote this Wednesday. And it didn't make, but it still fell 13 votes short of enough to override Governor Jay Nixon's veto. So, in 2015, Missouri will not become a right-to-work state. So that's some good news right there.
Indeed. Yeah. I thought Missouri already was a right-to-work state, so that's that's good to know.
Yeah, but they did have somebody who wanted to get rid of child labor laws in state
law. Oh, wow.
Oh, speaking of some labor laws, I got something here from Legal Dictionary.
Uh-huh.
Sexual harassment in the workplace is usually associated with a heterosexual.
Okay.
Aw, dang.
Okay.
Saved by the bell.
Right? Saved by the bell.
Okay.
Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, this is John Ryman calling.
Hi, John, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. How about yourself?
Good, good. So, okay, you're calling in to talk about the presidential campaign of Bernie Sanders. Now, before we start this off, I would just like to ask you a question. Did you hear this week about, I guess, Hillary Clinton finally starting to go on the offensive and basically call Bernie Sanders a danger to America and compared him to Jeremy Corbyn in Britain?
Yep.
And to quote, this is quote unquote from Bernie Sanders' mouth when he responded. Oh, they all, I'm sorry, let me back up. Hillary Clinton also compared Bernie Sanders to Hugo Chavez. Okay. Now, hold on, Bill. And his response was, I take offense to Ms. Clinton's statement that I'm somehow related to a dead communist dictator.
Oh, wait a minute. And also, too, thanks, Hillary, for, Mrs. Clinton, for insulting somebody who's probably going to be Prime Minister of England in the near future.
But what did you think of this? Did you know about this comment, John?
Yeah, I didn't. I knew about what he said about Chavez.
Yes.
But it's interesting, you know, the Wall Street Journal said that Corbyn makes Sanders appear to be a moderate.
Uh-huh.
But I just wanted to correct one thing. I was listening to what you were saying previously.
Yes.
You're mistaken about Nick Licata.
Oh.
He also is a corporate Democrat. He's just of the liberal variety.
Oh, okay. Very good. Thanks for that correction.
And that is in a lot of ways relevant to what we're talking about Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
Who is also another corporate liberal Democrat.
Okay.
Just like Licata, that Licata's at the local level. But, you know, in talking about Sanders, I just wanted to start by contrasting his campaign to something that's going on not so far from you in Chicago.
Okay.
I'm talking about the sit-in and the hunger strike of parents and community members to save a local high school, Diet High School.
Yes. We reported on that, I think, a couple Saturdays ago. Yes.
And maybe at some point you'd be interested in interviewing some of those hunger strikers. But in any case, I think that we should think about that and think about the Bernie Sanders campaign in light of the fact that what you have in the United States historically is unique in the industrial world, in that the working class here has never had a mass political party of its own. And the question I think that we have to ask ourselves is, how will such a party be built? And will it be built by grassroots community struggles, such as the struggles against racism and police brutality and murders by police and so on, or will it be built through the campaigns of somebody who is really the 21st century equivalent of a Cold War liberal?
Well, just to respond to that, I think that we really have to start critically challenging these groups that have the media presence, like Black Lives Matter, to construct an actual narrative that places police brutality and other forms of racial oppression in the context it needs to be in, which is capitalism. And I think that if we broaden the discussion and we force the Black Lives Matter group to actually read the history and use that history and use the social structures today to actually create an ideology and some type of structure behind what they do, then it would invite others to talk about the issue of labor as being part to being of the same substance, which is capitalist oppression. And until that happens, then we can't see a grassroots movement developing, because the focus right now is way too narrow, because they don't understand exactly why police brutality and racial oppression exists, because they refuse to engage capital.
The fact is that grassroots movements aren't springing up all across the country, just like the grass in springtime. Like I said about diet, which has nothing to do with a group of non-profiteers and others. It's actually coming from the community, like in Stockton, like in California, all different communities throughout the country. We're family members of people who have been killed by the police, where parents and students of schools that are being closed, all these throughout Colorado, for instance, where you have all kinds of community groups just springing up semi-spontaneously around the issue of fracking. And so you see this happening all across the country. It's a welling up from below. And I think that where that is heading, and in fact has already started in some places, is this grassroots movements starting to put up their own independent candidates. And by the nature of their very struggles, those candidates have to be, not because this has been thought out in advance, although it should be, but those candidates have to be outside of and opposed to the Republicans and the Democrats.
Yes, okay, so I think you hit a good point there. Is this something that has to start at the local level over the country? Yes. But somehow be coordinated, communicate with each other.
And then if you look at Bernie Sanders, who incidentally has waffled on the question of privatization of education, and who is a Democrat in all but name, he's made deals with all the top, for the last 10 years, he's made deals with all the top Democratic leaders, Senator Chuck Schumer, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, all these people. He's made electoral and political deals with all of them. He supports Israel. He supports drone warfare. Mm-hmm. He supported Bill Clinton's omnibus crime bill, which has led to mass incarceration of black people. Mm-hmm. He more or less has ignored the issue of racism and the police just running rampant.
Until he was confronted by Black Lives Matter. That's only when he started talking about it.
Yes. Yeah, so some people say, well, you know, he's talking about income inequality and all these things, and we should call on him to break from the Democrats. But that is like calling on a jumper from the Golden Gate Bridge to learn how to fly on the way down. It can't happen. Mm-hmm. That is a mistake in principle, because Sanders cannot and will not lead a movement to build an alternative to the Democratic Party. And so I think that, and sure, to an extent, sure we want to interact with the Sanders supporters, but you can't, it's a huge mistake to do that by waffling on the question of who Sanders is, and what he is, and by pretending that he actually can, no less will, lead a movement away from the Democratic Party. He can't do that.
You know, John, I agree with everything you said, and I especially the need for an independent working class party. It's something, you know, it was at one time we did have it in our history, but it didn't last, unfortunately.
Not on a mass scale, we have.
Yeah, Socialist right. Party under Eugene Debs.
And the Communist Party.
And
actually,
the Communist Party in the 30s, yes.
Mm-hmm. Too, yes.
Well, and there was a Labor Party up until a few years ago that actually got on the ballot in North Carolina through, I forget how many, 10,000 signatures, I believe, at least.
Yeah, but where is it now? That's the thing.
That's what I'm saying, it now? And I just really don't have much faith in anything like that. I just, I'm sorry. I, it mm-hmm. just, I, I, I want it to happen really bad, but I just can't see it.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, John. I mean, what I'm experiencing, you know, and I'm sure this, my experience isn't unique. I'm sure this has happened all over the country, is that, you know, I'm seeing all this excitement out there from working people, you know, that basically the last thing they want to see is Hillary Clinton get the presidential nomination. And they think that Bernie Sanders is a great alternative. They're all excited about him talking about, you know, living wages, single-payer health care, free college tuition, and stuff that's actually will affect their lives. And it's like you see this huge momentum and excitement and stuff. And I mean, what do you do?
I want to add something to that. On my jobs, it's Donald Trump.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And because of the immigration thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you got this. You know, I guess the thing is that, why I wanted you to call on the show is I thought this would be a good really interesting discussion, because frankly, I know Bernie Sanders' flaws and everything, and it's just like, okay, so we have a Democratic primary election coming up. This is not a general election, but a primary election. And what do you advocate for people to do? Just not vote in Democratic primary?
Well, of course, the workers' movement should not involve itself in the Democratic Party politics. It's been the death knell of neither the workers' movement nor the community movement. It's been the death knell for every social movement, no less the labor movement, for the last, 100 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he couldn't make it any clearer, you know, that what he is trying to do is lead like a certain mood of discontent, mainly amongst 20 and 30 something white people, or almost exclusively amongst them, lead that into the Democratic Party. I mean, he's said it in terms of that he's going to support the Democratic nominee. So that's what, and so, you know, that part, yes, it's a complete trap. And of course, you're not going to bait a trap with something that's not pleasant to people. You bait a trap with something that they're looking for.
Okay, but there's a lot of people out there, and I'm telling you, these are working class people. I've had this conversation going back 15 years or more, where there's a lot of working class people that are afraid to vote for a third party at this point in time.
Well, that's why I think that the focus of our struggle. I mean, what is the presidential race? It's really 90% a beauty pageant, isn't it?
No argument there. I mean, it seems like the president of the United States, even though he has a lot of powers, really is a puppet. I mean, every president I've seen.
Well, no, it's not a puppet, but he's like the number one salesman, except what he's selling is not used cars, it's U.S. capitalism. Mm-hmm. That's why, incidentally, Chris Christie will never stand a chance to get the nomination, because he's overweight. And he doesn't fit the mold. You have to have, as a man, you have to have good hair. You have to be at least 6 feet tall. You have to be in good physical condition. You have to be a good salesman.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I would say to people, you know, look, like, let's say as far as a union member, if you really want to make a change, let's start by getting organized within our unions and fighting to make our unions what they should be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just, and because this is not going to change anything. And Sanders, you know, he introduces all these wonderful bills, you know, like for free education and all that stuff. Well, it's literally like throwing a snowball into the fires of hell, because that's about how successful those bills are going to be, and he knows it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I really, now we did have Gus earlier before you came on, John, tell us about the great, really good outreach program that the SEIU has organized.
Well, I would be very
sorry. No.
I'm sorry, the GEO. Okay, because they're a different thing. But I cannot see. Sorry, man. God
that's
damn.
Okay. That's
like,
okay.
You're as bad as the guys at my job.
Sorry, Bill.
I'm sorry. It's an outreach program that the SEIU.
Well, sorry.
Biggie. Yes, GEO.
GEO, the Graduate Employees Organization of the University of Illinois. But I tell you one thing. There is no way that you're going to organize anything in the laborers And it's not going to be in the unions. At best, it's going to be across the unions with like-minded workers in unions and outside of unions. There's no way that I'm talking anything up with laborers. It's bad enough on my jobs as it is. The people I deal with are lumping.
Well, I
what do you mean by lumping, Bill, for listeners who might not know what that term means?
They're lumping proletarians, man. They're not good for anything except getting some work done.
Well, to an extent about the unions, to an agree with you in that if you look at what's happening throughout the country where there is actual struggles of working class people, in the main it's outside the unions because the leadership is such a huge barricade, such a huge blockage to anything. And so then if it's not within your union, in some unions it might be possible, and many unions maybe not, but like in Chicago with that Diet High School, or in Stockton around a particular case of police brutality, wherever there's struggles, then get involved in those local struggles. Because, you know, the campaign to elect this, that, or the other person president, I mean, it's not that it's unimportant because it shows where, you know, like in its own way, it shows what the capitalist class and their strategists are thinking. And we can't ignore that. But to advocate getting all involved in this campaign is, I think it's a mistake at best, especially with Sanders. And there's something else. My guess is that most of the Sanders supporters are believers in that whole strategy, that whole line that we hear all across the country, basically, vote for me and I'll set you free. And I think that the other part is that we have to campaign amongst people. No, you have to organize. You have to build organizations of struggle in your community, in your workplace, where possible in your union. To change things yourself, you cannot just leave it up to somebody else. And I'm not saying that we should ignore electoral politics. I'm not saying that we shouldn't run our own candidates. But that has to come out of the struggle of working class people and the organization of working class people of, by, and for themselves.
I can't argue with any of that, John. Let me ask you this.
Incidentally, Sanders has had no connection with for decades and decades.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he did come from a grassroots movement when he first got elected in Vermont to the city of Burlington, largest city.
Barack Obama was a community organizer.
Not really. We could go into that history. That's a myth.
I mean, okay. John Lewis came out of that. You know John Lewis, the congressman?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Out of that, too. And where is he now? He's nothing but a Democratic Party functionary also.
Yeah.
So what somebody did, you know, there is something to that song, What Have You Done For Me Lately?
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, let me ask you this. Do you think it would be better if Hillary Clinton won the Democratic nomination or Bernie Sanders? I mean, I'm just going to throw that out there since we're talking about the Democratic primary.
Yeah, but unless there's a real movement from mass movement from below in the next few months that transforms the face of American politics, Bernie Sanders is not going to win the nomination.
Mm-hmm. But what do you think? Let's put it this way. I mean, if Hillary Clinton wins the Democratic nomination, it's going to be another oligarch that's probably, you know, whoever wins the Democratic nomination with seeing the candidates from the Republican side is probably going to win the presidency. Do you think it'd be better? I mean, what do you think? Let's put it this way. Two different scenarios here. One, Hillary Clinton win the Democratic nomination, and two, Bernie Sanders pulling it off to where he actually won.
Say Sanders actually got elected president. What can he do, David?
Yeah, I'm just saying. No. John, you don't understand. I agree with
his own cabinet.
Yeah,
even his own fellow Democrats in the Senate will not support any nominees that would be any different. Mm-hmm. He couldn't even support Supreme Court
justice. Yeah, basically.
You misunderstand my question.
No, here, Dave. It's the idea. My idea.
No, I did understand your question.
Okay.
But the point is this. The very best that you can argue about Bernie Sanders as a president is the same as what people could have argued about Barack Obama, is that we will be driven backwards at a slightly slower pace.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
What we have to focus our energies on is figuring out how can we reverse direction.
Absolutely. But I'm just asking this question in this pure, just, you know, isolated question. Do you think for the workers' struggle in general, it would be better for Hillary Clinton or for Bernie Sanders to win the Democratic nomination?
But that's the wrong question.
Well, no, it's not.
The question is, how can we reverse direction?
Well, yeah, okay, in the long term, John, but what I'm saying is what do you think either one of them being elected is going to do to this workers' movement? Do you think if Bernie Sanders gets elected, that it would actually be worse? Or do you think it would be more that if Hillary Clinton got elected, it'd be worse in the sense that
it would be more confusing?
It'd be more confusing if Bernie Sanders got elected? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, but David.
No, I'm just saying, I just wanted to ask an opinion. It's not that I'm arguing one way or another, John. I'm just curious.
But by asking the question, you are raising a certain mindset. You are helping focus attention in a certain direction. And I think that focus of attention is mistaken. And, I mean, people said the exact same thing 8 years ago and 4 years ago as far as Obama.
Well, John, what you're saying, I believe, is that any person who gets elected will be so constrained by the larger, say, establishment.
Capitalist forces.
Right,
that
it's like, okay, you can say this about abortion, but, you know, just stay away from my money.
Well,
you know.
Well, what I'm saying is that we have to focus on what are the steps and through what avenue can the working class organize itself?
Yes.
To start to become an independent force in American society.
No argument there.
And that's not electing a president.
And in that case, will the election of Bernie Sanders in any way help that? And I would say no, it won't. In fact, in some ways, it'll confuse it.
Well, that's what that was the question I was trying to get at. Thank you. Finally.
And then you have the old situation that always pops up. You get a Democrat in office and there goes the anti-war movement. It's done, you know, or whatever. And there's no opposition to anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like one other thing that I would say to people who support Bernie Sanders in some way, you know, cause he's for against income inequality and all of that is I would like to see them justify their support for him to some parents in Gaza who a year ago had their little baby burned alive by Israeli napalm and white phosphorus, which Sanders supported. How will you justify your support of Sanders to them?
Mm-hmm.
We can't just think about, you know, the 28-year-old ex-college student who has a student debt that they can't pay off and can't afford to buy a house here. We have to think about those parents over there in Gaza, too.
Mm-hmm.
They're just as important.
John, thank you so much for calling in. This has been a real interesting conversation. And, I tell you what, this is, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, for sure.
People interested in hearing more and more from this perspective, I invite them to take a look at OaklandSocialist.com.
Open Socialist?
OaklandSocialist.com.
Okay, John, listen, thank you so much for calling in, and I'm sure we're going to be discussing this on the comment, the list server that we're both on and stuff, because there's been some real conversations on that.
Flame war.
Not really. It's more of a camaraderie, conversations, discussions.
Debate around ideas.
Yes. Okay, John,
right.
Thanks so much for calling.
Having me.
Take care.
OaklandSocialist.com.
Thank you.
List server.
Of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? A miner. Now always in the air and sun. He'll be with you, fellow workers, till the battle's won. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Across this great old nation, tell me what you gonna do. When there's one law for the rulers and one law for the ruled. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Okay, we're back. That was Tom Morello doing the old labor classic, Which Side Are You On? And just some quick public service announcements here. This month, Speaking of Democracy, we'll offer readings from the 1974 Ramparts Press book, Big Brother and the Holding Company, The World Behind Watergate. A compilation of previously published articles by noted authors, edited by Steve Weissman, joined host Doug Olive for an hour of information and good music Saturday, today, September 9th on WFT Community Radio from 1 to 2 p.m. Also, tomorrow on Sunday, check out Labor's Worldview TV, which is on every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 and live at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. And this Sunday, I believe, is part two of 9/11 Press for the Truth. And then following Sunday will be 9/11 Unanswered Questions. So got some. I've seen some new interesting films coming out from around the world that I definitely want to see get on.
Radio for All's got a pretty good 9/11 show by a woman named Cheryl. If you go to radioforall.net, okay, there's quite often a good episodes of a good 9/11.
We still put our archives up there at radioforall.net as well as at the WEF.org website.
Okay, it's good to know. And yes, you can download past programs of the World Labor Hour too at there and also at radioforall.net. Also, Latin American Film Festival is going to be this week at the Art Theater Co-op. Started Friday and runs through this Thursday, September 24th. The 6th annual CU Pride Festival. This is today in downtown Champaign, and I guess it starts at 5. I didn't know it was the 6th annual one. That's interesting. First film of the annual Social Justice Film Festival, Freedom Riders, threatened, attacked, and jailed Monday, September 21st, 6:30 p.m. at Red Herring at the Channing Murray Foundation. So anybody else have anything of interest that's happening in the community?
We're wrapping up our pledge drive at WEFT, so give us a call, 217-359-9338, or go to the website, weft.org. Click on the Support WEFT link. We can really use your help out there. As David likes to say, all of us like to say, you're not going to hear these kind of views and opinions and these kind of music programs on any other radio station in this area. So
no.
We can use your support, people. Please call
Definitely.
In.
Yes. And Gus, so what's going on with GM?
Well, amid all of the crazy stories coming out this past week, I mean, they have just totally buried this story of GM basically getting away with murder, because that's exactly what happened. And just to give, I want to give everybody this full perspective of what happened. The United States Justice Department, their announcement of what is called a deferred prosecution settlement Thursday in the case of the General Motors ignition switch scandal is a horrific human rights tragedy. It allows the multi-billion-dollar auto giant to get away virtually scot-free in the face of a massive criminal cover-up. And let me repeat that. It is a criminal cover-up of a deadly defect. It is the culmination of a whitewash by the Obama administration, federal regulators, and Congress, which have from the start sought to shield GM officials from the consequences of their murderous actions. Under terms of the agreement, GM will pay a $900 million fine relating to its role in the more than a decade-long cover-up of defective ignition switches tied to numerous fatal crashes, a tiny fraction of the company's $25 billion in profits since it came out of bankruptcy. No GM executives are being criminally charged despite full documentation that everybody can see showing that GM was aware of the defect since 2005 but took no action to warn customers or order a recall. All levels of the political establishment are implicated in this whitewash. And again, we're pointing directly to the federal government. President Obama has had a horrible week already, especially in dealing with the young 14-year-old young man who was put in handcuffs because he was a Muslim. And the president tweeted out he could come to the White House for astronaut week or whatever garbage he said. I mean, just totally erasing and getting away from the fact that this was an anti-Muslim and police repression issue. And he said nothing about
it. The kid built a clock, right?
He built a clock. Yeah, and people say that, well, it looked like, if people said it looked like a bomb, then how come they didn't evacuate the building? That's how you know that they knew it wasn't a bomb. They knew that, and they did it because he was a Muslim child, and it was police repression. And then Obama goes in and basically co-signs GM getting away with this horrific incident. So from the start, the media especially largely sought to downplay the affair, covering up the extent of the death and injury caused by GM's actions while accepting that as Good coined the company's claims that top officials were totally unaware of the problem until it hit the news in 2014, which documents prove is a lie. That by 2005, the top GM executives and the federal government knew that there was an ignition problem with these cars. So again, we have capitalists getting off the hook for murder. And I mean, this is something that 10 years of this that they could have stopped. They could have issued a recall and they did not do. And there are no criminal charges coming down the line. But again, when you get to the masses of people, the working class and poor people, if anything of the sort happens, we're immediately put in jails. We're immediately put in prisons to continue mass incarceration and private capital enterprise in jail system.
You know, just back on a bailout, right after Obama got elected. Yeah. It's like, you know, what's crazy is they got all this taxpayer money, but yet when under questioning the czar that Obama appointed, the auto czar that was supposed to manage this, couldn't answer the question that Ralph Nader asked at the congressional hearing, saying, is this whole financial situation, is this just General Motors North America, or is this General Motors International, which is the same company? He said he didn't know the answer to that.
Of course.
It was a scam. It was a scam. Because General Motors International was profitable. It was just the U.S. division of General Motors. And so they got all this money from the taxpayers. And what happened was the workers were forced to take lower wages. Mm-hmm. And the same management was allowed to stay in that ran the company into the ground in the first place. You know,
I heard somebody bring up today, I think, that corporations want to be treated as individuals when it comes to free speech.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to something like this, they want to be treated as a corporation so none of the individuals go to jail.
Exactly. Yes. I don't know how we're not at this point where people are not in the streets going insane, demanding that these people be brought to prosecution. How is the president of the United States, who's implicated in this, not speaking out against this corporation? How are the unions, particularly the United Auto Worker, and of course our favorite person, Dennis Williams, not issuing some type of statement about this, that these people got away with over 100 plus deaths, and nothing is going to happen but some ridiculous fine that's not going to do anything but go back into the pockets of the capitalists anyway.
Edward Bernays.
Okay. Yeah. The whole
whatever
public
they
relations,
do is
public propaganda.
Good because then we can go out and buy stuff.
Yeah.
Well and Dennis, they'll have jobs for us maybe.
Yeah, the head of the auto workers union, I mean, they bought into this team concept a long time ago.
Oh, God.
Oh, we're a team, you know. We gotta take one for the team, you know. And as far as Obama and the rest of the, you know, politicians, well, that's something called campaign contributions.
Yeah, have you ever heard of Ben Hamper?
No.
He used to write a column for Mother Jones when Michael Moore ran it called Rivet Head.
Uh-huh.
And he also wrote a book called Rivet Head about his experience working at General Motors in the early 1980s when they had in the 70s and 80s while they still kind of had the company over the barrel.
Okay.
So let me put this
amazing book.
Let me put this more into a historical context. In 2005, GM officially made it official that the ignition switch was messed up. But in 2001, that is when they started talking about problems with the Switch. It didn't meet minimum specifications, but decided to go into production anyway. So despite a flood of customer complaints, GM rejected the fix due to cost considerations. Again, cost considerations. Those capitalists can't mess with their profits. Later, GM quietly redesigned the Switch, but did not assign a new part number, a violation of engineering principles that pointed to a deliberate cover-up.
So this
goes beyond acknowledgement. This goes into conspiracy type stuff. Like, we're not going to mess up our property. We're not going to go to jail. We're not going to risk anything. And we're going to continue to have a cover-up going back to 2001 when they could have said, you know what? Let's take this thing off of production and let's see what goes on. Let's see.
The fine $900 million?
Yeah, $900 million.
What was their profits last year?
Oh, since the Obama bailout. Back during the recession, they made over $25 billion.
$25 billion. Wow, that sounds like a pretty profitable trade-off, if you ask me. $25 billion, not minus $900 million. That still leaves $24.1 billion.
And again, that's just off of the since the bailout. I mean, there's still profits that have since 2001. You know, there's been some profits made as well. So it's well over that much, but that's just the base minimum, the $25 billion that they made. So it's at the point now that the reason that this story is important is that we cannot allow this to be the status quo anymore. We cannot allow us to turn our heads and think about Bernie Sanders versus Hillary Clinton as presidential candidates when we have this type of conspiracy and murder going on at the highest levels. We need to be in the streets demanding that these people be prosecuted.
This has been covered recently by the corporate media as well as the alternative media, correct?
Definitely. Even the corporate media picked this up.
Yeah.
So it's at the point where everybody knows about this, but they've been kind of shying away from it because of all the other stories going on, especially with the 14-year-old boy. But we have to demand that these people be brought to what people consider to be justice. I don't believe in that in this country.
Donald Trump said that Carly Fiorina is ugly.
No. Yeah, that's important. You know, yeah. That's why we didn't get that story.
And
okay.
What is Kanye up to? I didn't see him or Kim anywhere this week.
Oh, that's horrible. Oh my God. That's the thing is, that's the kind of news, we need more of, Bill. I mean, we need more of that kind of news. More of those, celebrity gossip and kind of little distraction news.
Around the web.
Yeah.
Zergnet.
Are we going to start the Union Edge off with that new feature?
Yes, we are. Bob, tell the listeners a little bit about this new feature.
Labor history in 2 minutes.
Yeah, this is from the Illinois Labor History Society.
Exactly, yeah. And actually, today's feature is about Ronald Reagan, 1981, and the PATCO. So.
Oh, interesting. Man, we could do a whole show on that one.
We could do a whole series.
The whole series, yeah.
A month series.
Yeah, and I want to let the listeners know that next week we're going to be having labor cartoonist Gary Huck is going to call in. He worked for the UE, the United Electrical Workers Union, for years. You've seen, I've seen his cartoons around forever and didn't know it was him, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Speaking of Ronald Reagan, someday when the last remnants of humanity are huddled around the Arctic Circle, starving to death, dehydrated, sweating, they will have this devil creature in their mythology called the Reagan. And his number was 666.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. You've been listening to the World Labor Hour on this supporting community radio station, WFT. And until next week, be safe and power the people. Take care.
And this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1981. More than 400,000 union members marched in Labor Day's first Solidarity Day demonstration in Washington, D.C. The demonstration was called by the AFL-CIO to protest the Reagan administration's policies and the firing of striking air traffic controllers. At the beginning of August, nearly 13,000 air traffic controllers had walked out after talks with the Federal Aviation Administration collapsed. At least 7,000 flights were canceled on that day. The Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization wanted an annual wage increase and a reduction in work hours. The FAA counteroffer fell far short of what the union wanted. Reagan declared the strike was illegal and eventually fired every striking PATCO worker. President Reagan even went as far as to impose lifetime bans on rehiring any of these workers. The union was decertified in October of 1981. PATCO was just the beginning. Reagan Reagan's policies were definitely anti-union. He put union foes in control of the very agencies that were designed to protect and further the rights and interests of workers. He named Donald Dotson the chairman of the National Labor Relations Board. The NLRB oversees union representation elections and labor management bargaining. Dotson let his opinions on unions known when he said that unionized labor relations have been the major contributors to the decline and failure of once healthy industries and have caused destruction of individual freedom. Under Dotson, the board abandoned its purpose to promote collective bargaining. The NLRB settled only about half as many complaints of employers' illegal actions as the board during the Carter administration. Those that were settled upheld employers in 3/4 of the cases. The Reagan-era anti-union policies and attacks on workers have had serious repercussions that workers are still suffering from to this day.